Good morning. This is the time for oral argument for the en banc court. As you noticed, Justice Sadis on crutches. Call it justice abuse. This is the time for oral argument in these cases. I have asked counsel, Mr. John Petty and Mr. Terry McCarthy, to consider arguing the case of Blankenship v. State, number 66118, and Briones v. State, number 66944, together. The cases are not exactly the same, but involve the same subject matter. Is that approach acceptable, Mr. Petty?
It is, Your Honor.
Mr. McCarthy? Thank you very much. I was inclined to make you sit around and listen to foreclosure issues, but perhaps you'd rather go back to your office sooner.
Well, Mr. Gunderson has already assured me it was going to be a great argument.
So. Oh, really? good reason to leave. Okay, you ready to go, Mr. Petty?
I am here. Thank you. Good morning, Chief Justice, Justices, may it please the Court. My name is John Petty. I'm here on behalf of appellants in both actions, Mr. Blankenship and Mr. Briones. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time for rebuttal. I have a couple of clarifications. With regards to the Briones case, I had written in my fast-track statement at page 10 that Judge Sadler did not disclaim reliance on the PSI. In fact, at page 91 of the joint appendix, he expressly disclaims reliance. But I don't think that that has an effect on the underlying argument. But I just want to correct that because that was a mistake. The other thing that I want to inform the Court of is with regards to Mr. Blankenship. As this Court knows, down below in the trial court, counsel asked for probation with enrollment in specialty court as a condition of probation. Judge Flanagan did not grant that request and in fact, imposed a sentence of 12 to 32 months in the Nevada State Prison. So Mr. Blankenship was placed at the Northern Nevada Correctional Center. He has since paroled. I bring that to the Court's attention because if the Court agrees with me that these matters should be remanded for a look at the validity of the PSIs that are used in these cases, he can still go back for a resentencing hearing. But the question as to whether or not he would want to entertain a probationary status or whether he would want to expire his term on parole is a discussion that we would have to have because there are pros and cons either way. But I wanted to bring that to your attention for fear that by virtue of this having been paroled, this Court might think that the issue moot. If the Court would even harbor that idea, I would simply suggest that it's not moot because, as this Court observed in a case called Haney v. State, 124 Nevada, and I can't remember the page site. In that case, it was a situation where the defendant was sentenced on a gross misdemeanor. He was challenging the lack of credit for time served. He expired his sentence, but the Court ruled on the legal issues raised because it was capable of repetition yet evading review. And I would suggest that same analysis would apply to Mr. Blankenship. All right. With regards to the underlying merits of this action, both of these matters challenge the PSI to the extent that they both look behind the PSI with regards to the scoring that took place to reach the numerical value that was then generated and then purportedly utilized by the division to make a recommendation for incarceration in Mr. Blankenship's case and for a maximum sentence in Mr. Brioni's case. A difference between the two cases that the Court should be aware of is that with regards to Mr. Blankenship, it was an agreement to concur with the division of the division's recommendation by the state. And with regards to Mr. Briones, it was free to argue. But again, as I will argue in a minute, that distinction is a distinction without a difference. The crucial issue that we want to bring to the Court's attention in both of these appeals is this. The PSI, the scoring system that is used, is a highly subjective system. In Stockmeyer, a panel of this Court, and then later in Sasser, the full Court, said that PSIs should not contain or must not contain impalpable or highly suspect evidence. My colleague, Mr. McCarthy, would limit that phrase to factual matters that are contained in the report. And in fact, the cases that have discussed this are all challenges to factual matters that are contained in reports. So your cases would naturally focus on that. But we believe that that standard should also be applied to the underlying scoring of the PSI, because like the PSI factual matters, sentencing courts rely upon them, and the PSI travels with the defendant to the prison system for purposes of classification, programming, and eligibility for parole. So if there are errors either on the face of the PSI or errors as a result of the underlying methodology used to calculate the score, the courts are relying upon it and prisons are using it. So the harm.
You're not saying an error, though, in the numerical addition. You're saying that the methodology reflected in the PSP or whatever the initials are.
Yes, well, PSI. That's what we call it.
Well, but the scoring.
Oh, I'm sorry, yes.
The scoring mechanism that. That's not rigged correctly, and it doesn't take into account the ADA. It's a dated form and so on. For me, though, the question I had is, are you at a collision between, on the one hand, factual errors, which I understand the district court judge is expected to correct at the time of before the sentence is imposed, so that doesn't follow the defendant around for the rest of his years. But if it's a methodological challenge, you have the statute that says there shall be by regulation adopted under the Administrative Procedure Act that the chief shall proceed and do that. My understanding of that form is that's generated in reliance on a regulation that in turn was passed pursuant to that statutory mandate that gets reported to the legislature and reviewed and so on and so forth. The question I had, and I don't know the answer, it's not really briefed, is how do we deal with that kind of a challenge? The district court, the sentencing judge, is being asked to rule on the validity of a legislatively delegated administrative regulatory action, and it almost looks like something that should be brought by DEC relief or some, you know, an action under the ADA, like the Yeski case was actually an ADA suit. Is this appropriate in this context? Sorry for the long question.
No, I appreciate the question. I think it is appropriate. And the statute that you're referencing is NRS 213-10988.
Yes.
Subsection 1 requires that objective criteria be developed in order to provide the scoring element for the division. Subsection 3 gives them the opportunity to deviate or create standards so that, as in the Briones case, if there's a criminal history, they can account for that. And then, of course, subsection 4 and 5 are the reporting requirements that you mentioned. Where we see the error that we see here is notwithstanding the language in the statute, this mandatory language in the statute, in the Briones matter and in the Blankenship matter and in the Briones matter, both of the division representatives testified that the scoring instrument itself is a guideline. I mean, it's a guideline only. It does not bind them to their recommendations. They can deviate from them, but there's no training as to when and how and under what conditions.
But that's also part of the regulations. If you look at the Nevada Administrative Code, my understanding is that the PSP, Probation Success Probability Form, is 213590, and then you have 213630 that says you can deviate from 213590. Now, a lot of discretion, a lot of subjectivity in there, and I understand that, but it's still an attack on a regulation.
Right,
correct?
But our position here is that, first off, notwithstanding the code sections and the statutory language, it is remarkable. In the Blankenship matter, for example, that the probation officer, Ms. Pappas, who has a wealth of experience, did not refer to any of those provisions in giving guidance. In fact, she's testified there is no guidance, that the best that they do is they talk amongst themselves about the very subjective nature of this scoring, and that any four together could assess the same case and come to a separate conclusion. And in the other case, in the Briones case, the PUP officer, as attested to in an affidavit filed by trial counsel, basically said, I'm recommending, although the score would give a 16 to 72-month sentence, I'm recommending 48 to 120. Why? Notions of progressive sentencing. I suspect notions of progressive sentencing are captured in subsection 3 of the statute you and
so
I
are So you're saying they're not following their own regulations?
Well, they're not following their own regulations, or at least in the record it doesn't show that they are following those regulations, and that's the issue that I have. That's the question that counsel in Briones said to head with Judge Sadler. PMP comes in and they're telling you, Judge, that this score, this recommendation, the recommendation that's based on this score, is a completely objective resolution that we are offering to you in deciding what you're going to do with regards to your sentencing. But it's not. It is, when you press them for showing where the objectivity comes in, Ms. Pappas was very candid when she undercut any notion of objectivity with regards to scoring.
So you're saying it's kind of a Wizard of Oz deal where it looks good, but...
Yeah, it has the patina of merit. But what we're saying is that when the officer is coming before the court and saying there are no objective factors, there's no guidance that follows us, there's nothing that tells us when we can and cannot deviate.
Okay, counsel,
that is a suspect report.
Let's deal with another question within the question, and that is, having been a sentencing judge and looking at PSIs, which sometimes I found informative, other times I found maybe science fiction writing, to be blunt, I discounted them. And quite often, as was stated in the second one, the judge indicates that he wasn't relying on that document. I'm concerned because if I carry out what you are articulating, and I realize that these reports should be accurate and have a basis, but nonetheless, I don't want to see our district court judges being put in the same position the federal court judges are put in, where there's no discretion, where it's just you go down and over and you come up with the sentence. And you're almost saying without saying the judge should follow the PSI. And I think most of the judges look at the PSI as a tool, listen to arguments of counsel, which when I read through both cases, arguments were made talking about what was wrong with the PSIs, other things to be considered. In this first case, this person has a disability, you didn't take in the Disabilities Act, so on and so forth. This particular judge looked at it and said, well, based upon the acts that were done, I think this is appropriate, right, wrong, or indifferent. But I'm concerned, are we going to throw out the discretion of the court with this creeping mandate that you have to follow a PSI, or are we still allowing for discretion? Aside from the fact that the PSI should be correct.
Right. Let me assure you that I am not suggesting, I did not suggest this in the briefs, and I am not suggesting it today, that the district court judge should not have discretion in fashioning a sentence. And I am not saying that the district court judge is obligated to follow the recommendation of the division, or anybody else for that matter. I mean, the court has complete discretion. What I am saying is this. If we are going to present a document from the division, which supposedly creates at least a baseline for the court, the district court, to consider with regards to sentencing, whether the district court decides, okay, that's the division's recommendation, but I'm going to go up for these reasons, I'm exercising my discretion, and these are my reasons for going up, or I'm coming down from that baseline recommendation, and these are my reasons, that's fine, but when
you use the term, use the term baseline recommendations. The baseline recommendation really is that the judge has a sentencing discretion, and no sentencing, he can give a minimum and he can give a maximum, the truth in sentencing. That's his real baseline. Everything else after that is kind of an add-in. That's their baseline. It's not the court's baseline. It's not the statutory baseline.
I would say this, that the statute gives a range of sentence. A mandatory minimum, and then the maximum sentence. And that is the range within which the district court can sentence.
But, Mr. Petty, aren't you saying in this argument that this court, has held that the pre-sentence investigation reports are to be corrected if they're inaccurate, either because there are addition problems or mischaracterization or misapprehension about someone's mental capacity, or other factors. And if the district court is going to disregard the recommendation of the Division of Parole and Probation in exercising its discretion, it should say so, as Judge Sattler did. Is that your argument?
That is my argument.
What about the cases in which, and there are many, where the plea bargain says the parties will agree to the recommendation of the Division of Parole and Probation? There's a lot of those. Should these cases cause us concern that maybe those recommendations are not well founded based upon these instruments or the approach taken by the officers in the Division of Parole and Probation?
I have always had personal concern about a recommendation where the parties agree that they're going to simply concur in the recommendation of PNP. And the reason for that is because we did not know for many, many years how it is. I mean, we knew there was a scoring grid, but we did not know for many, many years just how these numbers were calculated and how they were taken from a raw score to a scoring score. We are now getting that information by virtue of subpoenas to PNP. So now we're getting a sense of how this is happening. I'm not certain that I would want to negotiate a case for concur with PNP when I know that there appears to be no cabining. There's no way to cabin the exercise of the discretion on the part of that probation officer. If he has or she has a negative interview, because that's the only other technique that was identified by Ms. Pappas, the interview and this PSP, if they have a bad interaction on the day that they're being interviewed, that's going to have an impact psychologically on how those scores are read.
You wanted to reserve some time, but I have one additional question in the Blankenship case.
I have a question, too.
With regard to that issue in the Blankenship case, could you explain or expand on the scoring differential that was made? Had the score been adjusted to recognize the mental deficiencies that were alleged, what impact that
would have? Very briefly, what happened was the score came out 60, the PNP score came out 60, which placed him in a borderline category, was testified that he could go either way. Ms. Pusage took the exact same scoring thing, but it credited the fact that he was double-dipped because of his disability. He was placed as unemployed and unemployable, and points were taken off. Because of his family life, it was characterized as disruptive, whatever that means, when it's just he and his wife who were living there. Now, they did have the issue that gave rise to the felony, but their relationship was hardly anything but disruptive. Ms. Pusage took those numbers, and they're in the joint appendix, and said that if those things had been adjusted for correctly, particularly the mental health issue, he would have had six additional points. Those six additional points would have placed him at 66, and that's well within the range of probation recommendation. So on the form, he should have got probation recommendation.
So are you saying that even if the judge exercises discretion and sentences Mr. Blankenship to prison, the Division of Parole and Probation should explain in the report why there's a deviation from the score?
Exactly. Even if the judge says, even if PNP had come back and said, you know what, you're right, we're going to deviate, we're going to show you that we were wrong, and this is what it should have been, Judge Flanagan still could have, in his exercise of discretion, imposed a prison sentence as opposed to probation. Absolutely. Of course, what he didn't do here, that he should have done, was under Sasser, he should have gone in and analyzed the challenges to the PSI so that and addressed them. I'm going to save my time if I might.
I think Justice Cherry.
I hope that he'll give you some more time because, you know, I come out of the federal court where they had sentencing guidelines and upward departure and downward departure. And with your argument, I think there's two different issues. One issue is to correct the PSI. That's the law. We've never had anybody except, I think, Justice Rose, when he was on the court, talk about appealing sentences. As long as the sentence was within the statutory framework, we don't even look at it. Now, Justice Rose, I think in some of his opinions, said we should start looking at sentences. What this does, Mr. Petty, it opens the door for this court to be annihilated with appeals on sentencings, which we've never done. But in the federal courts, the Ninth Circuit is loaded with cases on sentencing guidelines when they were mandatory, and then they were just a guideline, you know, suggested How do you answer, where's the authority that even lets you argue this case except for correction of the PSI?
Well,
and also one other thing, Clark, I'm glad you're from Washoe, because in Clark County, I don't even think the probation officers go to court anymore. When I started, there was always a probation officer there, usually who wrote the report. And there was no Ms. Pappas when I was a district court judge in the courtroom. We were lucky if anybody even showed up, even from the public defender's office, let alone the parole and probation, because they were always doing preliminary hearings.
Well, I'm happy to report that our office shows up.
I know. I was joking about it.
I know. And we do. We are fortunate. We do have PNP officers. Because in Washoe County, at any morning hearing, you have a mixture of sentencings, arraignments, probation revocations, competency evaluations, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So the PNP officer is there. It's not necessarily the one who wrote the report. But going back to your question, and I hope I answered this, I know that this court, there are a great number of cases where this court has said, we will not engage in sentencing review. But it seems as though there has been a trend sort of quietly creeping up, as evidenced by those cases that say the standard of review for a sentencing appeal is an abuse of discretion, that though you say you're not going to do it, you appear to be doing it. And if that's the case, I don't think you're going to be inundated with additional cases if you require PNP to explain their recommendation and any deviation off the major score. Because once again, the district court judge is not bound by it. It's only a recommendation. And if every district court judge does, as Judge Sadler did below, say, I am not relying on this recommendation, I make the following findings, and this supports my sentence, then you just have an abuse of discretion review.
But we don't have the cases in the criminal administration that we do in civil, like Brunzell and Beatty, where judges have to make findings. I rarely see a judge in Clark County. Probably in Washoe, it's a little different because it looked like Flanagan did make findings. If we're going to review sentencing, we're going to have findings, because if you want $500 worth of attorney's fees in this state, the judge has to make findings, otherwise we reverse. So we can't treat civil litigation different than criminal litigation, especially since there's due process issues here with findings. And somebody better tell the judges that handle criminal down in Clark County that they should start making findings.
Well, the issue, I'm not here to... Full disclosure, I think district court judges should be making findings on the record on a wide variety of things that they're not required to now. That's my own personal view. But that's not my argument today. My argument today is this PSI, in both cases, was suspect. And the court should not have relied upon it in the Blankenship case. And regardless of whether Judge Flanagan disclaimed, which he did, reliance on it in his case, it nonetheless created an atmosphere upon which Mr. Briones ended up with the maximum sentence of 48 to 120 months.
Okay, we'll give you additional time for the rebuttal.
All right, thank you.
Mr. McCarthy.
Mr. McCarthy, as you're coming forward, I have a question that could be easily posed to either side. I just didn't want to take up any more of Mr. Petty's time. If somewhere in your conversation with us here today, you could tell me whether or not there are other jurisdictions that have a different tool that they use, and if so, what those jurisdictions are to create the findings of a PSI. And if you don't know, that's fine, too.
I don't.
Thank you.
I have some minor experience with misdemeanor courts of Ohio, and they get some sort of help, but I couldn't tell you what it is.
Thank you.
And, of course, the federal courts get the report from the probation department.
Thank you.
So, good morning. I'm Terry McCarthy from the Washoe County District Attorney's Office. Let me first say on the subject of Mr. Briones, that should be simple to dispose of, as Judge Sattler disclaimed reliance on the report. And according to this court's decision in Buschauer, that should be the end of the hunt. In Buschauer, there was disputed evidence presented, and this court said, well, if the court's not going to rely on it, then it doesn't matter. So,
but even if a district court judge, as Judge Sattler did in this case, say I'm not going to rely on the pre-sentence investigation report, doesn't the judge still have an obligation to address potential conflicts or problems in that report that are pointed out by defense counsel?
Yes.
And wasn't that the thrust of Sasser?
I think that there is some obligation, but sometimes in criminal cases we define the remedy in terms of the issue And in this case, I think we define the issue in terms of the remedy that is sought. If the remedy that is sought is to remand for a new sentencing hearing, I say no. If the remedy is very simply the ability to make this argument to the trial court, that's an appropriate remedy, and he's already had it. Both of them have already had it. So that ought to be the consequence of these various statutes, is you have the ability to call the appropriate witness, whatever witness you want, and ask them, say, isn't there some degree of subjectivity in this? What is the basis, Mr. Probation Officer, of your claim that this person has a history of violence? Since the term violence is necessarily subjective. What brought on that subjective conclusion is more likely to be some objective determination. That is, well, you know, the history of this sort of crime.
But what about Mr. Petty's argument? I mean, I struggled to have this be fact-based or impalpable or highly suspect evidence-based, but he has a point that is the scoring system is fundamentally unfair when it docks this guy for being unemployed when his unemployment is due to a mental condition for which he's on full Social Security disability. I'm switching to Blankenship.
Right. That was
he wants to criticize that methodology and urge that at minimum a discretionary adjustment would have been appropriate and perhaps the form itself needs to be junked. Now, I have trouble because of the regulation and need to amend the regulation piece of that. But what about that argument? I mean, how does that fit what you're saying?
Well, what happened is that they did just that. We were able to explore this recommendation, and the probation department denied that any recommendation was based on the disability, and they said, well, we have plenty of other clients, defendants, whatever we're going to call them, who are employed with the same sort of disability.
But that's a quarrel with whether, I mean, to me what he's saying is, if it's a disabled individual who has been determined to be incapable of gainful employment, which is essentially a Social Security full-on disability determination, it is not fair to add or subtract the 4 to 6 points that your form does, or you should make an adjustment under your discretionary adjustment, parole and probation department. Where does that fit in this Sasser analysis, if at all?
The way I see it is what the Sasser analysis does is allows what happened in this case. That is to call the witness and explore the issues and argue.
And the judge didn't resolve it in either case, didn't resolve the dispute.
The judge gives whatever weight to it he finds as appropriate.
But doesn't Sasser require him to resolve it so that the PSI is corrected going forward, whether the guy goes to prison, goes to probation, goes to specialty court, the PSI is corrected?
If there is a factual dispute, I agree, there should be. There's no factual dispute here. Instead, the dispute is based on the use of the facts. And there's nothing to correct. If the one argument says, well, he's unemployed because he's disabled, and the other says, no, he's unemployed, I don't know that the judge has to resolve that.
There's a dispute over the scoring system. That would impact Blankenship in prison as to his qualification for certain programs.
Well, the sentence will, but not the scoring grid. That shouldn't have any effect.
The PSI will, and the PSI would affect parole. Now, he's on parole. Don't know what the facts were there, but it certainly would impact him throughout the rest of his remaining participation in the criminal justice system.
But I don't know how a district court would resolve this to say.
Well, but if a person gets the opportunity to raise the issue, what you're saying is the only remedy they have is to raise a dispute with the PSI. But if it's not resolved, or if it's resolved in a way in which the defendant believes is an abuse of discretion, that's not reviewable by this court?
Well, it's reviewable because we're here. But the nature of that review, I suggest, would be limited. More like, here's a common example. In habitual criminal cases, this court has said that the stale nature of the prior convictions doesn't have any special legal significance, but the court must consider it. And so the review is based on that. And so here we have, if evidence is presented in the form of testimony from a probation officer or anyone else, the court must consider it.
Well, let me stop you there. Let's go back to the actual facts in Mr. Blankenship's case and indulge me for a moment. Let's say there is no dispute but that his mental incapacity makes him unemployable, which is sort of what the Social Security Division has found. But let's accept that as true. He gets processed through the scoring system, and he does not get 4 to 6 points because he is not employed and not employable, right?
Yes.
And you're allowing him an audience with the district judge to raise that, but the answer is the parole and probation department is only following their own regulation and their own legislatively approved form, and it doesn't give you any points for being disabled. So he can air it, he can talk about it, but it's of no use to him because he's going to run into that wall of the methodology. And I'm not sure that the sentencing hearing is the place to evaluate that, but if not there, where does he say, hey, I'm not working because I choose not to work. I can't, and nobody will hire me.
When I don't think anyone would dispute that the judge can consider all that there is.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
The judge can consider, the sentencing judge can consider all that exists. So we have, you can consider that the fellow is unemployed, probably unemployable. And
so would that be something that would get attached to the PSI, a finding that the form doesn't accommodate this guy's disability? In your estimation under Sasser, is that the answer?
No, I don't think that that is a factual dispute.
Okay.
I think that under Sasser, when there is a factual dispute in the pre-sentence report, that ought to be corrected.
Okay, but there's no correction of this type of dispute, which is a methodological.
No, I think that in that sort of circumstance, the remedy is simply to be able to bring it up, to point it out, to ask the judge to give it appropriate weight, and the judge can decide, as in Briones, give it no weight at all.
What if the error is a math error? They subpoena the records, they do the calculation, and the PSI officer or writer made a math error. And it makes a difference between recommending prison or recommending probation.
I think if something like that is shown, then the judge should correct it, but probably
What if the judge doesn't correct it? Says, I'm not going to follow the PSI. I don't care what it says. I don't care what there's a math error. This guy's going to prison.
Well,
what if it's the opposite? What if the PNP recommends recommends time and the judge gives probation? Can you appeal? Because there's a math error?
No. There's no. We can bring to the court's attention an unlawful sentence, but not unlawful.
Why is it unlawful? The judge has discretion to do what he wants to do. Why is it unlawful?
It is not. That's what I'm saying. I was answering your question. No, we cannot bring it to the court's attention, except if it's unlawful and merely having a factual.
See, I read Sasser different. I'm not looking at Sasser. Sasser's good for correcting the PSI. I think every PSI should be corrected. It should be corrected in the district court, and we shouldn't even have to worry about it. It should be done there in the district court. But appealing sentencings, we've never allowed it as long as it's within the statute.
Well,
in other words, if it's within the robbery statute or the burglary statute, give me what case allows Mr. Petty to come up here? What case? I don't know the case.
Naovarath.
Pardon me?
Naovarath is the name of the case. And there's few and far between, but this court has indeed corrected lawful sentences in general when they were children. Naovarath, I believe, was 14 years old and got life without, and Justice Mowbray said that he too is a child of God, and reversed it. But this court has often said, you know, that the statutes give the right to appeal. What can be raised on appeal is another issue, and what can be raised successfully is quite another issue as well. So yes, this court can review a sentence, but the scope of the review ought to be whether there was some error leading to it, or if there was an unlawful sentence.
aren't we in a situation, though, where the defendant is entitled to a correct PSI per statute, even though the court is not mandated to have to follow it because of other things downstream that this document is used for?
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know that you can have a requirement that it be correct in all respects. What you have is that it must be must have a basis. So the factual issues must be corrected.
Isn't your position, Mr. McCarthy, a right without a remedy?
I'm sorry?
Isn't your position a right without a remedy?
Overrules some cases.
Well,
the right to raise it, but so what?
If well, the
district
court
judge
context,
says so what, then so what?
In the criminal context, I think that's pretty much it. You should be able to make the argument. And then the judge might err. The judge might say, well, you know, despite this problem that has arisen, I have decided to give great weight to this thing, even though it's factually incorrect. And I suppose that this court could intervene at that point. But I think we have to limit this appeal to the cases that we actually have. And that specter hasn't yet arisen. So in the case that we actually have, I suggest that there is no error, because what happened is the court listened to the arguments and court thought out the subjective aspects of the report, found out the factual basis for it, found there was no factual dispute, but only the dispute about whether the family life is in fact disruptive.
Well, where's the factual basis for that in this record? I looked for it and I couldn't find it.
I suspect that it is the instant crime. The family was involved in the in destroying their apartment.
So that sounds kind of disruptive. If your husband is complicit in your commission of a crime, then you're automatically in a disruptive family?
Well, it sounds like they acted with complicity.
Yes.
So, yes.
Yeah, okay.
And I can see where some...
Fair enough. I was just curious whether... I envisioned something different from a disruptive family life.
If there is, it's not clear to me what was meant by the report writer. But it certainly would be appropriate to inquire.
Yes.
And as I recall, though, the actual author of that didn't testify. And seems to me the defense successfully objected to the author's notes being used as evidence. And so
that takes it out of the...
No, it would seem to.
Yeah.
So I guess that's what I'm trying to say is that this worked the way it's supposed to work. Now, whether we ought to go through the administrative code, go through the legislature, and change this, that's beyond my role. I don't have an answer to it. But I think that in the context of this criminal appeal, we should not be doing anything except ruling that this happened the way it's supposed to happen. I would mention to this court that in Thomas...
They did argue. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but they argued that under Yeski and a Ninth Circuit case whose name escapes me, that the defendant in Blankenship was being penalized for his disability unlawfully under the ADA. Now, that would usually present as a suit under the ADA, but the argument was made at this hearing. So following up on Justice Hardesty's question, they get to ventilate this issue, but you're saying there's really no remedy for that?
I'm saying that.
Other than just suggesting it to the judge, and if the judge says, well, so what?
If that happened, if the judge were to say, because of your disability, I'm going to dunk you a little bit, I have no doubt that this court would have the ability to intervene.
Okay, but his point is that form is set up to do just that in cases involving disabled, mentally disabled people who can't work.
Well, so the issue hasn't been fully developed for various reasons, but we don't have a decision by the court.
And would that be appropriate under Sasser, or is that some new law, new analysis that we would have to do to reach that legal issue?
Well, I see Sasser as the correct factual errors, not the mode of analysis.
Right. So let's go with that then. If you have unlawful discrimination against disabled people in sentencing that occurred. Sasser, that's not a factual error. That's a legal methodological error. How would a defendant raise that and get relief?
Well,
under what law?
I suppose then.
The discretion of the sentencing judge is the answer to that? Is that the only answer we have?
Well, in the criminal context, unless the record demonstrates error. We have long since held that a silent record leads to the presumption that judges know what they're doing, that they disregard that which should be disregarded and pay attention to that which should be considered. So I would suggest that the silent record weighs in favor of doing nothing. But that if the record is developed such that the trial judge says, no, I find that your inability to get a job results in an extra 2 month sentence, certainly this court can intervene.
Should defense have to file a motion for resentencing so that there could be resentencing like there was in Atlanta for the educators when the judge said, you know what, I thought about it, and 7 years is too long, I'm going to make it 3 years.
Do we
put an obligation on the defense attorney to file a motion for resentencing before the judgment of conviction is signed?
Before it was final. That's going to be a trick.
This whole thing's a trick. I was in this trenches for 28 years. Believe me, every time they recommended time and I got probation, I never had an appeal. Thank goodness. They never appealed me. And I was always able to be successful in that. And I had the sentencing guidelines drove me crazy, drove me out of the federal court because I couldn't take it, even when they were just the guidelines.
You're not alone on that. Our law, our procedural law, doesn't allow for such a motion except before the entry of judgment, the written judgment, and that generally occurs the same day as the sentencing. So that's going to be a trick. And other states have taken different approaches. I mentioned Ohio. They have a provision for sending someone to prison for a couple months and then bringing them back and asking, how'd you like that? But we don't have that. Ours are final.
We used to have that at one time.
Uh-huh.
A long time ago.
I think they called it shock probation. I kind of liked it. We don't have that. And we would have to ask the legislature. And I don't think they're asking me. So if I answered your question, sir.
Well, you don't want us to expand Sasser is what you're saying.
I don't see it beyond the factual questions.
Of correcting the PSI.
Right. The rest of it, the subjective aspects of the evaluation, which have to exist. You know, I think that the remedy is simply to inquire, to bring it out, and to urge the judge to give no weight to it because it's incorrect. You can have a debate about whether someone has a history of violence. Well, the remedy is to bring it out. To bring it up to the judge, what is this based on? To call the probation officer as a witness and say, where'd you come up with this history of violence? And if he says, well, it was that old armed robbery conviction, you know, then you've had the remedy that you're entitled to.
But there are many instances when I was a sentencing judge where it was pointed out that the PSI had an incorrect conviction on it.
Right.
And the defendant seeks to have that removed, at least Sasser would require that to be removed, and removing it could impact the scoring and the recommendation.
And maybe when that happens, the appropriate thing to do, when there is a factual, by the way, I'm out of time, if I can keep talking.
You can answer my
Thank
question.
Maybe the correct thing to do, certainly the correct thing to do is make the correction. And it does happen. I'm aware of that. And based on Sasser and Stockmeyer, courts are now being explicit and resolving it. When the fellow says that trespass in Stockton, that's not me, courts inquire, and they generally try to believe the defendant, and they make the correction. It may also be appropriate, then, to ask the division for a new recommendation, or at least to ask the representative who was there, would this affect the recommendation? And find out the answer that way. But we don't have that case here.
We could also demand that you have a meeting with parole and probation before the sentencing to correct the pre-sentence report. That's what they do in the federal court. You meet with the probation officer, you go over the guidelines, you go over the upgrade, upward departures and downward departures, and then you get to the judge. And still there's a massive amount of appeals in the Ninth Circuit, a massive amount of appeals on upward departures and downward departures, which is time versus probation in the state court.
I see that lawyers are invited. That doesn't mean we can make them show up. And some do and some don't. And I don't have any comment on whether that's appropriate or not. So.
It'll be interesting when we get the Clark County PD and the Clark County DA on issues like this, where there's 100 public defenders and an equal amount of DAs doing sentencing every day.
If that happens and you want to consolidate some cases, I'll be here.
And I'm sure if I may, I've got one very simple little question.
Sure.
On Briones, I'm still trying to understand the problem here, because although the objection was as to progressive sentencing, the judge, Judge Sattler in this case, basically indicated, well, that's not what I'm relying on. I'm not relying on the PSA. I'm relying on the numerous previous convictions, and, that's what I'm basing my sentence on. And if that's a misunderstanding, I'd like to know.
That is not a misunderstanding. That is precisely what happened.
Okay.
And I suggest for precisely that reason there is no error for this court to review. In Buschauer, this court said when the sentencing judge disclaims reliance on disputed evidence, we believe him.
Well, and he specifically addressed the objections that were made at that particular time.
Right, and he said, I'm basing this entirely on my own evaluation of this defendant's criminal history. That is not really reviewable. So,
well, is there anything else in your opinion that you think you ought to have done?
I can't think of a thing.
Thank you.
Imagine that. Thank you, Mr. McCarthy.
You call like mine have a different idea.
Mr. Petty, as you approach on the same question, too, that I asked Mr. McCarthy, do you know of other jurisdictions that may use a different scoring tool to compile their PSI?
I don't know what that instrument is. I have to assume that other jurisdictions have instruments that have been validated, that have some sort of internal calibration technique so that same officers or different officers can reach the same kind of conclusion.
There's no best practice model or recommended.
I don't have anything to offer to you this morning.
Thank you.
With regards to the Briones case, I just want to bring to the court's attention that if the PSI isn't corrected, or if some of the information in there isn't corrected, the prison system doesn't get a copy of the sentencing transcript. So the fact that in Briones, Judge Sattler said, I'm not going to pay attention to the PSI, what the prison system is going to get is the PSI and the judgment, which mirror each other, and I think a reasonable inference can be, oh, we follow the recommendation of PNP. The problem with Briones, Justice Barragheri, is that A scoring actually turned out a score of 16 to 72 months, not 48 to 120, or it might have been 26 to 120 if an additional element of dangerousness had been added. But these facts were pretty innocuous. The guy broke open a window of a car with a rock and took $2 of change from an unoccupied car. My point is...
But if it's within the sentencing guidelines there, or if it's within the being a legal sentence, the judge has that discretion to impose whatever he wants.
That's right. But the PSI has information in there that might be misleading. And so to the extent that a request that it be corrected somewhere, somehow, at some point, maybe an addendum pointing out that the underlying score should have been 16 to 72, but for reasons of progressive sentencing, these are factors that can be used in the prison system to decide classification, et cetera, et cetera.
But if the judge is specifically denied relying on that.
But in Stockmeyer.
You just say, no, Judge, you did rely on it no matter what you said.
Not relying on it, but in Stockmeyer, the court panel said, even if it doesn't affect the sentence, it can have an effect in the prison system with regards to classification, et cetera, et cetera. So those PSIs have to be corrected, whether the district court judge relies upon them or not, expressly disclaims them or not. It's not just the district court that relies upon them. It is the prison system itself. And if I might just briefly just comment one other thing. This gets to the impotency of making the argument and then having the judge say, either ignore it completely and go on and rattle off the factors that are going to give rise to the sentence, as what happened in Flanagan's case, Judge Flanagan's case, pardon me, or completely disclaim, as what happened in Judge Sadler's case. The fact of the matter is those PSIs are going to go to the prison. They're going to get funneled in there, and it's going to affect the prison. Thank you.
Any other questions for Mr. Petty? All right. Thank you very much, gentlemen, for your excellent arguments and for joining these cases together for argument and your briefs. They will both stand submitted.